You're listening to Faith from the Margins, a spirited dialogue into the intersection of faith and identity.
Hi friends, this is Andres, and yes, we are back with a new episode here at Faith from the Margins. We have been working really hard to make this happen because we wanted to end our season with a lot of energy and momentum. I want to say thank you to all of you who have been supporting us since season one, and also those who are just listening for the first time or just a couple of times. We are grateful for your support and for going through this journey with us. I also want to thank St. Stephen's Episcopal Church for their support and for the great team that I have the pleasure to work alongside each day who make this happen. In today's episode, we talk with the Reverend Benjamin Perry. He is the Minister of Outreach and Media Strategy at Middle Church in New York City, and he is also an award-winning writer. We were hoping to release this podcast before his book came out, but we were not able to do that. We are releasing the episode today, and this is also the day that his new book comes out and is now available. So please check the episode notes to learn more about Ben's new book that you can order now or get in your local library. The title of the book is Cry Baby, Why Our Tears Matter. And the topic of our conversation had to do with, of course, the new book and our culture, how our culture views crying and emotions, how this relates to masculinity and femininity, and also the spiritual dimension of crying, tears, emotion. What does spirituality have to do with all of this? If this sounds interesting to you, now all you have to do is listen to Benjamin's wisdom. Here we go. Thank you, Benjamin, for being here with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Andres. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to get to know you more and to learn more about your work and your experiences. I wanted to start, before we talk more in depth about your new book, which we will do a lot today, I wanted, if possible, if you could share with us some of the experiences or what happened in your life that brought you to write this book.
Yeah, I would be delighted to. So this book starts well before I started writing it. I cried a lot as a kid, and then for a variety of reasons that I'm sure we'll get into, I stopped. And so by the time I was maybe 13 years old, I didn't cry at all. And I didn't cry for about a decade. And then I started seminary, and I recognized we had a teacher who invited us, you know, to think about the last time that we cried. And everybody was going around and sharing all of these beautiful memories about when they had cried and what it meant to them. And as the, you know, proverbial talking stick was coming around to me, I realized I didn't have anything. And I was like, oh, that's probably not healthy. Not only could I not remember the last time I cried, it was so long ago that I could remember times I had cried as a child, but I definitely couldn't remember the last time because it was so far in the recesses of my memory. And so I decided if I was going to be a spiritual leader who was offering care for others, I needed to uncover for myself why I was all of a sudden unable to feel. Or not all of a sudden, for the last decade, I had not really been able to feel deeply. And so I started this spiritual experiment, if you will, where I made myself cry every day for like 6 months. Truly a absolutely lunatic thing to do. But it was an attempt to teach myself how to feel again. And I didn't actually start out with the intention of, oh, I'm going to cry every day for 6 months. What I decided after that day was, oh, I need to make myself cry again. And so I went home and I remember thinking it was going to be so easy. Like I would be able to just go there and be like, oh yeah, of course, it's crying. Like it's everybody cries, you know, how hard can it be? And I went home and I tried everything and I just couldn't make myself cry. And it literally took things like thinking about my parents dying and what would I say to them? What was left unsaid to actually make myself feel enough again that I started to cry. But when I did cry, I felt incredible. I felt alive again in a way that I hadn't in years. And so that was when, after this experience of crying and, you know, feeling resurrection in my body, if you will, I all of a sudden had this recognition that something inside of me had been broken for a very long time. And I had this inkling that perhaps getting myself to cry every day would be a way of repairing that. And so over the course of the next months, I just was determined, okay, I'm going to cry every day. And so I would go through my, you know, life. And then at the end of the day, when I would go back and do my work for my classes and stuff, before I would go out and hang out with my friends, I would say, okay, one of the things I need to do is I need to make myself cry. And what was really interesting over the course of those months is that by, you know, month three or four, it had gotten so much easier to cry. And it was just becoming a habitual thing for me, to the point where a lot of days I didn't have to go home at the end of the day and cry because I had already cried in a worship service, or because a classmate had told a beautiful story. Something had happened that just made me cry organically. And I just became a person who felt more deeply. I became a person who was more emotionally available. And so I just got to watch as the experience of crying sort of retaught myself somatically what it meant to be human, what it meant to be embodied. But that was all, you know, a decade ago. So, you know, fast forward another 10 years to the beginning of the pandemic, I was living in Washington Heights, right next to Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. Mm-hmm. And I was watching as they were parking morgue trucks out in the street because so many people had died, they couldn't fit them in the morgue. Wow. And as this was happening, there was this perverse, you know, we need to return to normalcy. We need to like get, you know, all of that was happening. You know, Ron DeSantis being like, why are we shutting down businesses? And it was this surreal experience of watching so many of my neighbors die that we literally didn't have room for them in the morgue. And then other people saying, well, what's really important is we need to get back to work. And I realized that there was just so much unnamed grief. Mm. So, and that feeling, you know, brought back the experience for me of those times when I hadn't cried. Like there was so much that I was feeling that I had suppressed, that I had buried deep within myself, that I wasn't letting out. And so I wrote an article for the Religion News Service that ended up getting picked up by the Washington Post, talking about, you know, using my own story of learning how to cry again as a microcosm for what I think this country needs to do, that we need to collectively learn how to grieve, collectively learn how to feel, how to name the pain we're experiencing because we're not doing it now. And the article really, you know, people found it resonant and it caught on, and an editor reached out to me and said, hey, have you ever thought about writing a whole book about crying? And I said, no, I haven't, but... The more I started to think about it, the more I realized that crying so neatly mapped onto both my own personal journey as a human person, but also a lot of the things that I wanted to talk about anyways, the things I care most about. So things like queerness and race and gender and class, all these issues that I think a lot about, all of a sudden crying became this doorway. And so I used tears as a means to refract all of these conversations I wanted to be having about other things as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing some of the background. I think that that's very helpful to understand how you got to this point, but also that is this work has been also personal. It's not just like a theory that I'm going to share about crying and why you should cry. It's really based on like your own experience. And like you said, also seeing what is happening in our world, how quickly we are to like minimize emotions or not take it serious or like want to ignore it. Similar to what you were saying about the pandemic when people were just like, oh, we just need to get back to normal. Like, and nothing was happening. So thank you for that. I have a question for, you know, there might be people, and I'm sure you have probably encountered them already, who are more hesitant about this idea of crying or why is it important, or have doubts about this, if it's really important or helpful or healthy or whatever adjective they might want to use. What would you share with them, or what would you tell them specifically?
Yeah, I think the first thing that I would say, and I did a lot of interviews for this book as part of the process of writing it, because I wanted to be able to collect more stories about crying than just what I carried within my own body, because I, like everybody, approach you know, anything I think about from a particular social location, and I wanted to make sure that, you know, in a book all about crying, that I'm bringing in more perspectives than my own. And one of the things that I would say, first and foremost, as much as I'm an evangelist for tears, if you will, as much as I'm someone who really believes in the power of crying and think that it can be personally healing and socially transformative, I also want to name very explicitly that there are very good reasons why people distrust crying, why people feel like they can't cry personally, why people feel like, you know, when they have cried, it hasn't been met tenderness. It hasn't, you know, it's opened themselves to harm. You know, unfortunately, we live in a country where there are so many landmines planted around crying, and they're different for every person, but there are almost no social locations, kinds, you know, like personal experiences that don't have their own impediments to you know, crying openly. So, you know, folks who are, you know, men or masculine, you know, acculturated forces, the folks, there's, you know, all the toxic masculinity that we grow up with, you know, the experiences that I certainly had of people making fun of me for crying, or making fun of other, you know, boys in my class for crying, that I watched and said, oh my God, I need to not do that because I want to be bullied, you know. But then for, you know, women, femmes, we have, you know, all these other different, you know, cultural constraints, things like, oh, if you cry, then you're not going to be treated seriously as a professional, or if you cry, you know, you're going to be viewed as sentimental and weak. You know, for folks of color, we have, you know, all sorts of ways that we suppress tears, you know, both in just the sort of discount, the general discounting that this country does, you know, in the way that it basically does not believe in the veracity of, you know, the crying of communities of color. When you'll see things like a, you know, the, you know, a police trial, and the, you know, white tears of a defendant will be honored, whereas, you know, white tears of family of a victim are discounted and, you know, summarily discarded. Or the way that, you know, in a really extreme example, I mean, what is a Black Lives Matter protest but an expression of communal grief, of, you know, of communal pain and suffering? And look at the way that our country responds to that, you know, with tear gas and tanks. And so I think that, you know, when people recognize that oftentimes the way that this world responds to vulnerability is through aggression and violence, whether that's, you know, physical violence in the extreme, or, you know, very quotidianly emotional violence, it becomes entirely natural to be wary of crying. Add into that mix the way that tears are also weaponized by other people. When you have folks like Kyle Rittenhouse weeping, like demonstrably and histrionically on the stand in order to get away with murder, or you have Brett Kavanaugh weeping to excuse his sexual assault of Christine Blasey Ford, or you have, you know, Amy Cooper weeping in Central Park to try to get the police to come and, you know, arrest Christian Cooper. There are so many ways that tears are also wielded as power that, again, make people distrustful of crying as an authentic emotional expression. All of that is not to say that crying isn't healing, that crying isn't socially transformative. It is, and it can be. But if we're going to have a conversation about, you know, what I believe to be true about the social transformation that crying engenders, the kind of personal healing it can nourish, we also need to be honest about the reasons why people are scared of crying.
Thank you for that. Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I think it seems like you said, it's so ingrained in all of our cultures, like work culture or even family culture. And in some spaces, even in church, it's not like positive to cry. And also, I think you are touching on another area, which is because people are uncomfortable with others crying or their own crying. They don't really know what to do when someone is crying. So they're trying to kind of fix this problem or make it go away or tell them something so they just will stop crying. But then they don't allow the space for the actual process to happen.
One of the smartest things that someone ever taught me about crying was when I was doing clinical pastoral education at a hospital. So working as a chaplain, my supervisor told me that, you know, when someone's crying, very frequently what we do is we put our, you know, hand on their back and we rub it in a circle. And that's, on the one hand, you know, I'm not saying that like that's an evil action or something. It's, you know, meant to comfort. But what she was saying is that it also communicates our own anxiety. It communicates my anxiety with your crying that, oh, I really wish you would stop crying. Whereas if you just put your hand on their back and leave it there, that's more of a nonverbal communication that, like, I'm here for you. I see that you're crying. You're not alone. But it doesn't communicate the same kind of personal anxiety with the other person's tears. And I think that we do that in a lot of different ways. Like, that's a really, you know, small, but I think, you know, a beautiful encapsulation of that dynamic. But I think it happens more broadly. And a lot of that time, you know, in the same way that, you know, that circular motion is intended to soothe in our own heads, a lot of the kinds of, you know, ways that we suppress crying, they're not always coming from, you know, a bully being like, what, are you going to cry? Like, that's a very, you know, particular kind of image that we think about. But, you know, for example, I was in some of my interviews with folks who were the first generation children of immigrants. They talked about how they very much, as much as they now want to cry more, and some of them are having their own children and they're trying to tell their kids it's okay to cry, they recognize their parents telling them not to cry as kids as an expression of love because they saw how hard the world was for their parents, and their parents were trying to make them tough enough to endure a world that had not been gentle to them. And so even as they don't necessarily want to teach that same thing to their children, they recognize that the reason why they felt, you know, well, why their parents were trying to make them not cry as kids wasn't because that they were like rude or, you know, unfeeling or mean or abusive. It was because their parents had not, you know, had the opportunity to be vulnerable in the world in the way that they, you know, should have been able to. And so they really see that as an expression of love. And so I think that those kinds of nuances are something we really need to be attentive to.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree that if there were more spaces that people sell safe, that they wouldn't be judged, or that they will actually, like you said, I think believing what's the story behind the tears, or believing what the harm or the hurt that people are expressing, I think that would change a lot of the ways that people feel about crying, or about crying with others, or crying in public. And of course, I think, like you said, masculinity and this toxic masculinity culture is also plays a big role on not crying or not expressing any other emotions.
Well, that it's not any emotion. The thing that's interesting to me about toxic masculinity is that somehow anger has been treated as if it wasn't an emotion. And so you know, these people are like, oh, I'm not being emotional. You're like, yes, you are. You're very angry right now. But we've constructed a culture where somehow, you know, that inhibition to be emotional doesn't apply to the one emotion that a lot of men are then channel all of their other feelings into. And so because you've been told to suppress any feelings of weakness, of anxiety, of vulnerability, of shame, of guilt, of fear, all these emotions that you're told, oh, you shouldn't experience because it's not manly to experience them, then get funneled into the one emotional outlet. So you have a lot of men who the only way they can process emotions at all is through anger. It's like happy and anger. Those are the two that I have. And so if I'm feeling any kind of those negative, you know, affects, it's going to come out as anger because I don't have the emotional tools for it to come out otherwise.
Yes, I definitely agree. And it's been, so this society has made it that this is almost like I expect this is what men have to express. Anger is okay. Everything else is not okay. you talk about in the book also, and you have mentioned it a little bit, about the connection between kind of crying and spirituality, or crying as a spiritual practice. I don't know if you would use that language, but would you talk more about that?
I would love to. One of the things that I say in the book is that crying is prophetic. And I mean that in the true biblical sense of prophecy, not, you know, telling the future, but in the ways that we see biblical prophets acting. So like, what does a biblical prophet do? They disrupt the silence. They disrupt the present order. They, you know, call people towards justice. They remind people of God's presence in our communal life. These are the kinds of actions that I actually think crying embodies. One of the things that I think is beautiful about crying when we allow ourselves to be open about it, is that it disrupts the silence. So many of us walk around feeling like, oh, everybody else must have their stuff together. It's only me that feels this way. It's only me that is feeling this sense of dread or this sense of anxiety or this deep sadness. And when we keep that inside, we reinforce this cultural silence, this cultural expectation that we're all going to ask each other, how are you doing? And you're going to say, good. How are you doing? Good. And when we cry, it actually breaks and disrupts that, you know, placid calm to reveal what's truly going on. And I think there is so much more suffering that so many more people are carrying around in their bodies that is going unnamed, that actually to be open about that and to cry is also a signal to other people that they can cry as well. I was talking to Kevin Garcia recently, and he was talking about the privilege of going second. And I think that that's a beautiful way that sort of crying acts as a prophetic act, is it invites and gives other people the privilege of going second, the privilege of crying and not being okay, and knowing that, oh, that's all right, because here's this other person who in front of me is naming their own vulnerability. I also think that, you know, it calls out an injustice as well. You know, crying, you know, people will say like, oh, singing is our first and best prayer, or I think crying is you know, one of our first and best prayers. It's an honest confession to God of how we're feeling. It's an honest confession to ourselves of how we're feeling. If we're being really honest and not crying as a way to, you know, deceive others or to, you know, setting aside all those kinds of gross things, if we're really just being present with our emotions and we start to cry, it's hard to lie to yourself in ways that, you know, when I construct a nice prayer with words, I can be good about, you know, sandpapering down the rough edges or convincing myself that I don't truly feel what I'm feeling. There's a sort of nakedness in crying that strips all of that away. And then it also reminds us that we live in community. One of the things that's beautiful about crying is when they've done studies across culture, there have been studies where they've, you know, one of the studies I talk about in my book was in something like 40-something countries across 6 continents with 7,000 participants. And what they found is that in every single country, seeing somebody crying made the people more statistically significantly more likely to offer assistance. This isn't a cultural thing. It's a human thing. When we see somebody crying, our bodies are hardwired to respond. That's evolutionarily adaptive. It's part of, you know, who we developed to be as humans. And so unless that, you know, empathic drive has been somehow extinguished by an external force, which for most people it's not, most people, I think, when they see somebody crying, there's a part of you, even if you don't necessarily go offer that response, there's a part of you that goes, oh my God, that person's upset. Yeah. I should do something to help. And I think that if we had a culture where more people were felt open about crying, we would also have a culture where more people would offer, you know, unsolicited assistance and help to their neighbors. And it reminds people that you are not actually going through this alone, that you are living in a community, that you are connected to the people around you. And I think that, you know, is a religious act in the true sense of, you know, etymological sense of religion, like religare, to bind, to connect. You know, crying does that. Crying connects us.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that you are saying that really resonate with me. I think first, what you were saying about how we are so, like, we respond automatically when people ask us, look, how are you doing? How are you? I also did clinical pastoral education, and one of my supervisors said, well, if you are asking people how they're doing, you make sure that you really want to hear their response. Like, because then people say they're not doing fine, and you're like, oh, like, I wasn't expecting this. What am I supposed to do now? Or like, it's surprising when we are so used to people saying they're okay, but then when people say something different, we're like, oh. The other thing that you were mentioning is like, and I'm thinking a lot about it in relation with social media, like if you were mentioning that people can feel like they're the only ones who are feeling this way, or they're the only ones that are struggling. And I think, you know, with social media that happens a lot more than really before, because we're seeing everyone in social media portraying like these vacations or these trips or having fun. It almost seems like too perfect that other people can then feel more like their problems are, that they're the only ones having problems or more isolated. So definitely, I can definitely see a lot of the relationships there. And I think the piece about community is also very important, especially when we think about a state community and how that can relate to what we're doing in church or as a faith community. Well, we don't have much time left, sadly, but if people want to pre-order your book or learn more about the book, where can they do that?
Yeah, so you can pre-order the book anywhere books are sold. You can go to your local bookstore and say, hey, I'd like to order Cry Baby, Why Our Tears Matter. If you don't want to pre-order it, go to your local library and say, hey, we're great. There's this amazing new book about crying coming out. Can you get it for the library? That's also an amazing way to to help spread the word. You can find me on the various social medias, Twitter and Instagram, at FaithfullyBP. I talk about crying and do stuff on there. But I'm really, really excited about this book, and I poured a lot of myself into it, and it feels amazing to know that it's going to go into the world and be read by people, connect to people. And so I hope that you're able to pick it up, and that you read a little bit. And one of the things that people have been asking me, you know, what do you hope this book does? And the piece that I hope, if you pick this book up and you read it, that you take away is just unwinding some of the shame that so many of us carry around tears. I think a lot of us grew up with a lot of shame around crying, for a lot of the reasons that, you know, I've mentioned earlier. And then we grow up into people, and then so many of us carry around shame because we feel like we're not emotionally available. We feel like we can't cry. I was really surprised when I was, you know, when I wrote the book and I've been telling people about it, I get two reactions. I get people who say, oh my God, I'm a huge crier. Let me tell you all of my experiences crying. And that's wonderful and beautiful, and I love it. And then I get people who tell me, oh my God, I wish I could cry. And I can't. And I wasn't expecting the number of people who are walking around like that. So particularly if you're that kind of person, I think what I'm hopeful of is not that you read this book and learn how to cry again, although that happens, fabulous. Yeah. But I hope that you at least start to dig into some of, you know, that shame that you're carrying around, and understand that that shame is not yours. Mm. Not your shame to carry. It's not your fault. It's not something that you did wrong. You live in a country, in a culture that punishes tears in so many different ways. That tells us not to feel, that tells us not to be vulnerable. And I hope by sort of exploring some of that and the different, you know, chapters on the social conditions of crying that I have, start to realize the sort of nets that are built around the weeping, I hope that you can start to be gentler with yourself.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Benjamin, for your time, for your wisdom. And for our listeners, if you check the episode notes, you can find all the links so you can connect with Ben and his work. And also, hopefully, you can pre-order the book and then connect with him and tell him your opinion, your experiences, and we can continue to have this conversation. Thank you again.
Thanks so much, Andres.